In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani, Seth Payne here, 713-572-4610, 572-4610, if you'd like to be a part of the show. Good morning, appreciate you joining us. A lot of funny comments coming through on the texts and YouTube, Seth. The cynicism alive and well on this show in regards to...
Directed towards whom?
Well... all of us, really. We're all taking a little bit. But Jeremy Pena, I love it, from the 832. Y'all think Jeremy Pena's now known glass ribs will help us in contract negotiations?
No, it won't. And honestly, obviously joking, but it won't, just because it's not a soft tissue injury where a guy's just continually either hurting his Achilles or getting sprained ankles, or, you know, Carlos Correa for a long time, it was his back when he was a younger player.
Yeah,
that was what people would be more concerned about, is, man, he seems to have these back issues. He figured that out. Yeah, the broken ribs are just something that happens when a baseball hits you sometimes.
I had two words for the person to text that in. I said, no, the reason being Scott Boras.
Yeah. We saw Carlos Correa, who had also had his rib issue, and that wasn't by a baseball. That was by allegedly a massage therapist's hands. He had his share of injury issues, including the one that kept him from signing his first two contracts that he had in free agency, because he had this mysterious lower leg issue, and he still got paid.
Rob Torres on YouTube says, just waiting to hear the news that Pena's in the hospital with a chest tube. I said, come on, man. Killing me. Chest tube. He's always worst case scenario, Rob.
There was. I mean, I was amazed that there were some people that were accusing others of overreacting after he got hit in the ribs, and there was no report of a break yet. There were people that were saying, oh, stop being so negative. Why are you expecting to have broken ribs? It's not negativity. It's using past results to inform what might happen in the future.
Yeah, well, and
it's not a guarantee of future results, but it'll tell you something.
The fact we have to do that with the Astros almost on a weekly basis is it's troubling to
me. Yeah, I need to read my SEC disclaimer that I use for financial products. Yeah, past performance does not indicate future results. No, it does. It does with the Astros, damn it.
Hey, talking about past performances, interesting segue. I feel like this has been more of a thing in hindsight. The offseason that C.J. Stroud had last year, you know, when he was traveling all over the world with Micah Parsons and sumo wrestling and doing podcasts, and just everywhere you looked, it seemed like, hey, C.J.'s doing something. Even here in town, what was he at the J.J. Watt Celebrity Softball Tournament with, that woman.
He was with the older lady there, James Harden's ex.
I can't remember.
She's 15 years younger than me, but older lady.
The picture that I saw of her last year at that time, significantly older than CJ for sure. Amber Rose, that's who it was. Yeah, just an innocent little carpool and a drop off at her place, I think, is what got people all up in arms. But no, so there was that, you know, and I feel like people mention this, and John McClain, who joins us on Area 45 every Wednesday, has mentioned this a number of times, and you see it, you know, written about and other areas from the national people, like, he's more focused this year. CJ's more focused this year than he was last year, as if he was not focused on coming off of a spectacular rookie season and trying to figure out how he can get even better, like as if that didn't happen. What did you think at the time? Be honest. What did you think at the time last year when you're watching all of that transpire with CJ during offseason?
Yeah, we've been 100% honest and transparent about that. I would say during the offseason last year, I'm trying not to be a grumpy old man that acts like these kids should never be doing anything except eating Wheaties and working out and all of that. It's a different era in which a lot of guys that are not doing anything extravagant necessarily in the offseason just... Everything that they do ends up on social media, so it gives the impression of guys that are just out living the jet set life and not caring. So I fought against it, but I never leaned too heavily into it during the season like it was an issue or anything. I fought against my own tendencies. Yeah. Like, I was cool with, okay, you're doing... I would prefer that, and CJ's learned this lesson. He cited Peyton Manning teaching him this lesson. I didn't like seeing Peyton Manning get into, like, if somebody asks you to power rank the best quarterbacks in the league, you just don't do it. Yeah. Like, that's the kind of stuff that ended up being a little bit, like, more extra drama that a quarterback doesn't need to be inviting either onto himself or onto a team. But it's not, in the grand scheme of things, a huge deal. The struggle with CJ last year more so was the classic thing that quarterbacks go through, especially when they don't have good offensive line or pass protection in front of them, where you got to adjust to the adjustments and what defenses are doing to stop your offense specifically. That was just something that sometimes there's no preparing for it until you actually see it in real time.
Yeah.
So I wasn't too worried about his offseason schedule last year.
I wasn't either. I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was very normal for a guy that literally made all of the rounds on Super Bowl Radio Row after the season that he had, and it bleeds into, you know, him doing things with another, you know, superstar in the league and kind of becoming like the face that he is now and is going to be at whatever level for the NFL as another young, budding, really good quarterback for the Houston Texans, mind you, this time. Think about that and then what he's doing this year. I thought this was kind of interesting. C.J. Stroud recently took a trip, and I think he took a number of teammates with him. I think I saw Tank Dell with him and maybe John Mechie.
Okay, there's two. You could talk about the Milan one first, and then the other one you're talking about was in Toronto.
They didn't go to the Milan one with him? That's what I was getting at.
That wasn't what was clear to me. I didn't know if it was just one happened after the other. After he was in Milan, there was he was in Toronto.
Yeah, and maybe they didn't go.
Xavier Hutchinson.
Maybe they didn't go, but the Milan one, the trip to Italy, I thought was kind of interesting. He went and toured the facilities of Inter Milan Soccer Club, and they did a sit-down interview with him and kind of got his impression of what he thought and, well, what he was doing there. Take a listen.
How have you liked it so far? What did you see, something that you liked in particular?
I like the trophy. The trophies are really cool, just all the history, and then the wall of, you know, the years of where it's back to the start now to where it is in the present, so... Just the history of everything and the trophies, all the wins you guys have had, it makes me, you know, want to win. And so, yeah, it's been cool.
So here's where my mind went with, you know, in hindsight, I feel like is where it happens most. Like people looking at like, CJ should have been more focused and, you know, not as much in the public eye last year, whereas he needs to be doing more of this. He needs to be seeking motivation and he needs to be looking at, ways to get better and learning his new offense under Nick Haley and things like that. But it was the first one where I was like, man, seeking motivation. I had a question for you. As a former player and now as a person that covers the Texans and follows the league, how have you seen like quarterbacks change or I guess evolve into like what motivates them in their search for that to improve from year to year?
I don't know. I don't know if anything's like as I don't think that anything's changed really. Like I don't like the really good quarterbacks are always the guys who are internally driven and, you know, most critical on themselves, just obsessed with it. And like I don't know if that's changed at all. I guess maybe the way that they're covered from social media and everything has changed, so you get more insight into their personal lives and their workouts and all of those other things. I mean, you got camera crews following them around in season for either Hard Knocks or the Netflix series and all of that. But at the end of the day, I like the things that drive really, really successful people the best. Like, has that really changed for anybody in terms of,
well,
like, no matter, like, from the 1950s until now, I think those guys are all generally wired pretty much the same way.
The reason why I ask is there's more money involved now. There's more opportunity for guys to afford themselves the ability to go seek out and do different things and learn different things. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. And maybe this was not at all like at the forefront of CJ's mind when he set out and, you know, did this trip. And maybe it's only something that he kind of stumbles upon is like, man, look at these trophies. What quarterback doesn't want to walk into their place of work and their stadium and their clubhouse locker room and see a trophy that they helped win, that, you know, they contributed to? And that's got to be some sort of like internal motivation that exists maybe more now than it did before for guys that didn't have like the opportunity to do it. because I feel like social media and media in general kind of drives a lot more of these things now than it did 15, 20, 30 years ago.
I like that. I'd be really skeptical that CJ specifically went on a trip to Italy just to be inspired by Inter Milano. The most likely explanation is he had some kind of a brand deal with him. So I guess like that's probably,
there is an NFL relationship cooking there that he's very much a part of.
Yeah, they're doing some kind of a business related trip or whatever it might be. It's a really good point. Like, I don't think, like, most great quarterbacks always look to other great quarterbacks to look for inspiration, or you've got stories going back forever about, Joe Montana meeting with whomever and whatever. I think the opportunities and the things that they can do to improve are way different now than what they were in the past. Like, you look at Jaden Daniels. Jaden Daniels and his use of that VR system, that virtual reality system, was probably the thing that transformed him into what he is. He started using that virtual reality system at LSU and continues to use it, and it really, really works for him. Those options have been available for like 10 or 15 years, but most of the previous versions were just crap. I think guys have, and then you look at Josh Allen. One of the things that changed Josh Allen and how he became a more accurate quarterback was just the computer analysis of his throwing motion and really fine tuning exactly where he's putting the weight on his feet. So back in the day, accuracy was almost considered an inborn trait. So there were a lot of quarterbacks that just figured, yep, they're either accurate or they're not. And I'm not going to tweak too much. I'm going to dance with the one who brung me, and the mechanics might not change all that much. Now they look at them more like pitchers, to where they can so much fine tune and refine things that the guys who really care about it, like Brady, his entire career kept working with the pitching coach, who I'm blanking on his name. I think that part's changed. I think Brady kind of set the bar for, all right, this is how much you actually can improve a lot of the physical traits that a lot of other people thought were innate and just unteachable. That you see a lot more of that with younger quarterbacks.
No, I think it's a good point, and it's a little bit closer to where I was going in my mind, is the example that you gave with Tom Brady and kind of the cross sport, training in, how is this guy, pitching coach, how he approaches his athletes and teaches them, what can he do with me? How can he apply some things to me and my skill sets in a different sport that are going to, kind of take me next level? I think that's interesting. Where I was going with it is, from an exterior, like motivational kind of a standpoint, like CJ seems like a guy that is very curious about a lot of things. You go to a training camp practice with him, and he's got a regimen where, he's doing non-football activities to kind of warm up and, get loose. So he's swinging, acting like he's swinging a golf club, or doing, some very like basketball movements, lateral movements, quick stuff, just something to kind of get ready for that day, right? Well, you could do those things from a mental standpoint, and there have been countless stories before where, baseball players want to go see how soccer players train and how they can maybe apply certain ideas or skill sets or practices to their craft.
Yeah. And your original question was, what are the motivations? I don't know if the motivations have changed. I think the actual tools that they have at their disposal,
the things that motivate.
But I guess if your original question is like, are they more motivated by money than they used to be, or there's more money to be motivated by, but in any industry or any field, really, the things that actually drive you tend to be more above and beyond just money, in that sport. There's a certain obsession with it that those guys would be, that they have the financial ability to do more, and they've got more tools at their disposal now than previous guys might have been. Like, you can easily justify, if I spend $1 million a year on performance enhancement, and it's just 2% of your salary, like, there's a lot more you can do.
It's a no-brainer, too.
If he did want to fly to Inter Milano just to talk to their coach or the players or something for inspiration, that's 100% more available to guys now than it used to be.
So you mentioned like the trip to Toronto where Tank Dell, Xavier Hutchinson, Jaden Higgins, John Mechie, Jalen Knoll, Jared Wayne, like basically all the receivers were there. Where's Nico? They all went, you know, to Toronto together. This is something that is very common for quarterbacks to kind of do with their receivers. I feel like CJ did this maybe last off season, or it had to be last off season, right? Didn't he do some kind of a camp in California or something with his guys?
They were out at I think they were at Cal, right? They were at Cal or UCLA. They were just working out at UCLA.
Yeah, yeah. Those kind of a team building, you know, moments that you can have like before training camp starts. I love that. And my mind went like John Mechie in particular, well, Xavier Hutchinson too, from a receiver standpoint, those guys are entering into what I would call like their most pivotal training camp in their professional career. This is huge for them because of two other guys that are on the trip with them in Jalen Knoll and Jaden Higgins. they need production behind Nico Collins and Christian Kirk, which I feel like a lot of people for some reason are afraid to kind of hang their hat on. Like Christian Kirk's been a very good receiver, but this is a huge training camp for Mechie and Hutchinson. Anything that they can get to be a step ahead or get ready before camp would be huge for them.
Yeah, no, and for Jaden Higgins and Jalen Knoll especially, I was curious about that. Okay, how much time is CJ going to have with those guys beforehand? It's hard to form that relationship just with training camp reps, and CJ didn't have that time versus OTAs and minicamp until the end there to really do a whole lot with these guys, as much as he probably would have wanted. So the fun part of this is that CJ got, I think he, in a lot of ways, got more of an education in his second season than he did in his first season. The difficulty level got ratcheted up so much that the kind of tips that CJ can dole out to a Jaden Higgins and Jalen Knoll this year is that much better than it was last year. And I would include in that the time that CJ spent with Stephon Diggs, I think, was probably really valuable. Everything that CJ could have learned from Stephon Diggs with what Diggs was focusing on this time of year when they were thrown together, what things to look for and all of that. That's where I think CJ's true value, if you go back to Tom Brady, Tom Brady's value in a lot of ways was he was a really good wide receivers coach. Like he just had those guys so dialed in to how to respond to different coverages, to how to respond to different looks that you can have that almost ESP level connection with them.
Yeah.
That's where I think CJ is going to be a much better wide receivers coach this year than he would have been this time.
It's funny you say that because I was thinking of Nico Collins, like tongue in cheek asking like, hey, where's Nico on this, you know, Toronto trip? You know, if these guys are spending time together and, you know, just trying to do as much as they possibly can, and, you know, learning a new offense this offseason under Nick Haley, he should probably be there. And I thought, you know, Texans All Access interview that Nico did earlier this offseason with him was kind of interesting because he was talking about like, hey, yeah, you know, now I'm kind of like the old guy in there now with Knoll and Higgins coming in. You know, Tank Dell obviously still a little younger than he is, but he also has Christian Kirk, you know, as a veteran that, you know, has probably some tricks of the trade, some ins and outs. But Nico learned from Andre Johnson. Nico's tried to emulate, who is it, Julio Jones that they always comp him to, or he talks about being an inspiration to him coming up. I thought like, hey, you know what? Nico's going to help in that regard too in camp with these guys when they're around each other more often.
Yeah, I'm not stressed out about him not being at the private workout.
No, I'm not either. I was thinking like that would be a great opportunity too, though.
No. The cool thing about the way the draft played out is that you're kind of set up with a mentor and a mentee with both the wide receiver, the rookie wide receivers. You got Nico Collins, who's a big body dude who runs routes like a smaller guy.
That's what
Jaden Higgins aspires to be. And then with Jalen Knoll, you've got Christian Kirk in front of him, where the playing slot receiver, it's a lot like playing quarterback. You got to get really, really good at understanding coverages and getting your pre-snap keys and all of those things.
So to
have Christian Kirk in front of Jalen Knoll, that smooths that transition out a lot. And that part, I don't know, you know, that's something that a lot of coaches or GMs strive for. It's not the specific reason you would draft a guy on draft day, but it worked out pretty well. Like I kind of like with the Rockets where you look at, oh, wow, they signed Clint Capela and it, it makes a whole lot of sense just in terms of, okay, now you've got some redundancy there at backup center.
Yeah.
Capella's not a young guy anymore.
Affordable depth.
Capella and Steven Adams being the pretty much the same age was the shock to me. That's the one that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me in my brain. But I think the tutelage factor can be huge. You just don't. I don't want to put it on Nico Collins that like he's responsible for Jaden Higgins' development.
No, not that at all. I was just saying that he feels like he can do that. That's almost like a job of his. You know, now at his stage of a Texans career.
Hey, by the way, this is where you got to be. You got to, when it comes to things like soccer and basketball, uh-huh. I always defer to Sean Pendergast's intelligence on these things. So when I was looking at the show prep and I saw it written Inter Milano, I was like, oh, I always thought it was Inter Milan, but I'm going to say Inter Milano, like it's a cookie or something.
So, I thought of Milano's.
You got to be extra careful with the typos on those things. Because yeah. I just said Inter Milano like three times earlier this segment. I'm like, no, wait, it's definitely Inter Milan.
Yeah. Pendergast would have corrected you on that
No. But he also would have written it in the show prep wrong. usually that's because he's drinking when he does the show prep.
He's Seth Payne. I'm Sean Bajani. In for said Sean Pendergast. Damian Pierce was a guest on Texans All Access last night with Mark Vandermeer and John Harris. A lot of good stuff from Damian. There always is. I love listening to this guy talk. He's so fun. Always dropping the knowledge. One of maybe the most transparent Texans that I can remember them having in any year. Lucky to have Damian Pierce, who's entering his fourth year. And just like I'd mentioned, Seth, along with John Metchie and Xavier Hutchinson, Damian Pierce, in my opinion, is one of those guys that's going into a pivotal training camp for himself, along with Darian Gumbawale. They asked him last night how he's taken to the new offense under Nick Caley.
It just comes down to how Coach Caley has organized and taught the playbook. You know, it's one thing to have a lot of plays and, you know, have a lot of players at your disposal. Oh, we got this for that situation. But if everybody don't understand it and they don't click and stick, it's kind of hard to go out there on game day and be completely confident in what you're doing. So Coach Caley has done a great job of, you know, micromanaging the playbook these last 3 weeks, you know, with phase one, phase two, phase three. You know, he's just been introducing bit by bit. And we've just been understanding the whole picture as offense just that way. And you can tell him, man, he brings the juice every day. He's enthusiastic about what he does. He believes in what he does. And that's what we're buying into. That's what we're doing right now. This is what OTAs is for. Like, we're buying in right now. We're trusting what he got on the paper. And everybody seemed comfortable to me. That's one thing I can definitely tell you from last year coming this year. Everybody seems comfortable. Everybody seems confident in what they're doing. And, man, we got some good things brewing up.
Well, that's good news to hear from Damian.
Yeah, well, you expect to hear positive stuff. I think the theme that I keep getting from either Nick Caley in his interviews or guys talking about Nick Caley is how dialed in he is on the fundamentals and on just the technique side of things. And when it comes to engineering a run game, for instance, when you've got an offensive coordinator who's got a passing background, that can be great in a lot of regards, but sometimes those guys aren't as fully educated about everything in the game, including like the run game became almost an afterthought for a decade or so in the NFL until all of a sudden last year teams are realizing, wow, defenses have also turned into being awful against the run. Let's run the ball. So that part of it, like the trend and the pendulum swinging back towards, whether you're the Eagles or the Ravens, running the football has its merits and it makes everything else better. But with Slowik, I never really got the sense that he was a technique guy. I felt like he was more of a scheme guy. With Caley, the fact that he's coached tight end as a position coach means that he's been heavily involved in both run blocking and pass protection, all those other things, but also the technique side of things. One of the things, and forget Caley's, time in New England. I'm not making a direct, bring this from New England. Just Bill Belichick as a coach in general, the thing that always impressed me the most about watching clips of him in practice was how he could get down in the dirt and coach specific techniques to players. That a lot of times, as much as they laud the offense or the defense of those Patriots teams for the X's and O's, it really was at the ground level being better at coaching technique in a lot of ways. And that was something that was just drastically off last year with the offensive line. You could look, if you're a good high school coach, you could have watched the Texans offensive line last year and questioned, like, why? this is how coaches operate. They're like, I don't know if I would have done it that way. Then maybe there's something I'm missing. So if you're a high school coach that was watching the offensive line and thinking like, maybe there's something I'm missing. I just don't, that doesn't seem like proper tech. No, you're 100% right. That was not proper technique. It was just bad.
Yeah.
There was just bad fundamental football at tight end, at wide receiver. And a lot of that all flows back up to the offensive coordinator.
I can co-sign that even just as a former middle school offensive line coach. It was just, you look at some of that stuff last year and it's like, there's no way it's supposed to happen that way. Like, well, these guys' keys are all wrong.
You can't always, this is what's so frustrating when I always fact check myself with offensive linemen when I want to criticize the offensive line. Yeah. And it's always hard because the offensive linemen tend to be annoyingly pretty bright guys. And usually what I'll say something like, okay, so this is Kenyon Green's fault, right? 100%. And they're always like, well, it could have actually been one of seven things.
yes.
But I got tired of sending it to, so I would send it to those guys, you know, like Wade Smith, Drew Hodgson, former Texans player. I'll send stuff to Owen Daniels sometimes when it involves a tight end.
Yeah.
And I've never had so many times this last year of them saying like, I got to tell you, I'm not sure what's going on here. I'm not going to blame Kenyon Green, but I also know that of these three guys here, at least two of them are doing the wrong thing.
There was that one time earlier in the season with the Texans last year. It was one of Laramie Tunsil's really, really bad games. Okay. And I mean, really, really bad games. Like one where he had like four, maybe false start penalties within it and maybe a holding. There was a sequence where I think it was three straight plays, Seth, he just reminded me of it. It was a Laramie Tunsil, false start. And then it was whoever was playing left guard at the time. I don't know if it was Kenyon at that stage or not, but he had like a crick or something in his neck and he kind of moved a funky way and that elicited a flag for a false start. And then the next one was Juice Scruggs, who kind of yanked his head up a little too quick and that was a false start. And you just mentioned like, well, it could be this thing or that thing. It was literally that way with the Texans. Like you had this Zapruder that at some points last season to figure out like, well, why is it this bad? Why are these guys moving all over the place? They were all just about as panicky and anxious looking as as anything.
It was and it was worse than that, though, Sean. Because it was the Vikings game. They were in field goal range there at the Minnesota 25.
Probably that.
It was third and four. It was the Tunsil false start, then the Juice Scruggs false start, then the Laramie Tunsil false start.
Yeah, yeah.
So they'd gone from being in field goal range at third and four.
That's right.
To finally third and 19. And that was an incomplete pass to Nico Collins. Wouldn't have mattered if it was complete because Laramie Tunsil had been flagged for illegal formation. Penalty was declined and the Texans ended
up. Do you have
punting.
This sequence like in Bolden, like on your computer somewhere, like where you can reference it? Like you're way
it's
too
bookmarked.
Familiar with this.
It's bookmarked. Yeah. Because I came up too many times. I referenced it enough times that I wanted to be sure about it. It was four straight. Yeah. It was four straight pre-snap penalties.
Oh, Lord.
It was just unbelievable. It was unbelievable. That was the most infuriating game ever.
Oh, my goodness. Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. With getting back to Damian Pierce and something that you'd said, with what maybe we think we know or can devolve from Nick Caley and, you know, where he's come from, the systems that he's learned under the McVay tree and so on and so forth, like the signing of Nick Chubb. Texans utilizing running backs more as pass catchers out of the backfield, maybe something to anticipate this year. They asked Damian Pierce last night on Texans All Access about his ability and comfortability to be used that way.
Me, I've always just been a football player. That's the first thing everybody learned playing football, playing catch. That's how everybody got introduced to playing football. And one thing about me, the way I approach catching the ball is kind of fun. You know, every ball is not going to be the best ball. Like, I remember growing up, well, we used to play a lot of games involving football, but one of them used to be like, we used to call it like, it's kind of like the same theme as like the ground is lava. So if the ball touched the ground,
right.
You out. So the objective of us was like to throw you the craziest ball. Like, it was no good balls in that drill. So like, we'll be in the square, throw it low, high, like just try to make you do these crazy catches. And like, that's like, we used to bet on that. Like, we'll probably put a dollar in, and you know what I'm saying? Or we'll put the, what they call it, the Fruit by the Foot. So I remember we had Fruit by the Foot, Slim Jim, and a ring pop in one time. So just
Andy up with the ring pop.
Yeah, man, you already know. So just catching the football, you know, I take a lot of pride. Like you said, it's a thing that comes natural to me. You know, I don't feel out of place not catching the football. Now, me personally, I like being in open space. I like me one-on-one.
The thing that I always get nervous about with Damian Pierce and Nick Caserio, we disagree on this. We had a disagreement about this. I don't like the last couple years version of a slender, sleeker Damian Pierce. Just and Nick said, hey, he's as strong as he's ever been in the weight room. You know, he actually gained muscle, lost body fat. There's no replacement for heft sometimes. And I'll go back to Jerome Bettis. I don't know if Jerome Bettis would have been a better running back if he were 20 pounds lighter. Because Bettis was a lot like, his running style was a little bit like Damian Pierce in that he wasn't necessarily bulldozing people. He just broke tackles. Like, there were other running backs that I didn't want to, I would be more fearful of him lowering his shoulder into me. But Bettis was a guy that you would think you had lined up for a perfect form tackle, and then you just bounce off of him.
Yeah.
Because he was such a large human.
Well, that's what made him is his size.
I don't need to hear about Damian Pierce and his pass catching ability. I want to see back the Jerome Bettis version from his rookie year, where maybe he was a little bit more rotund, but he broke tackles because that's his superpower. Well, and they've got guy. You drafted a guy in Woody Marks to be your receiving threat. I need Damian Pierce to be a guy that can go in there, and if let's say one of the two guys ahead of him on the depth chart right now end up being injured, or both of them are injured at some point, that he can go in and just bulldoze yardage for you.
I totally get that, but help me understand this, because I'm always on the other side of the fence when people say, well, you know, look, the Texans have, you know, the guy, whether it be a Joe Mixon or a Nick Chubb, they've got those guys that can, you know, catch passes out of the backfield and stuff like that, and be the versatile, you know, the power backs as well, and break tackles. Why can't Damian Pierce be both? Like, in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't want to have, like, predictable personnel on a football field. Like, and I feel like that's a place that we've gone to before, you know, from a Texans point of view, even in the Slowick system, that you know what they're going to do based off of, like, who's out there.
So what's your question? Like, what?
Well, you're saying, like, Damian Pierce, like, you don't need him to be a pass catcher.
You can use him as a receiver. I just don't think that that's what he needs to hang his hat on. Like, yes, by all means, anybody on the field at any given moment needs to become a receiver, potentially. I just, like, the thing that made Damian Pierce special in his rookie year had really nothing to do with the stuff in space or being semblance of a scat back or anything. Like, he's struggling to, he's fighting to make the team. So he needs to be viable as a wide receiver.
There you go.
I think that sometimes trying to cram a guy into a prototype of a player that he just most definitively is not, it does more harm to that player and the team itself.
Yeah.
So
I
see. No, by all means, yes. Use him as a receiver when there's opportunities there. It's just that's not his calling card, and it likely never will be.
Yeah, I see. All right, we're on the same page then. We're on the same page. One more from Damian Pierce. Speaking of, like, being in space, why has he been such a good kick return guy for the Texans? The space has something to do with it.
It really not so much adapting, because I was a great returner like my whole life. It got to a point in high school where, like, they'll onside kick it rather than kick it to me. Right. So my coach was like, bro, you know, don't even worry about it. They're going to do all this. We just going to keep y'all. So, you know, kick return is just, like, me and Coach Frank like to call it a longer run play.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Like, it got to the point where Coach Frank, you know, we was thinking about this, adding this in the scheme, adding a little fold here. And then one day he was just like, man, you know, DP, I'm just going to tell you which two guys we double team and we're going to go from there. Like, and he has that trust in me. And I have that confidence in him to put me in the right position as well. So, you know, being with Coach Frank and, like you said, over the years, just gaining that trust and building that relationship and seeing it, you know, manifest on the field has been great.
Seth, I would say this. Talking about, like, the pivotal camp that this is for Damian Pierce, does it not benefit him greatly, the fact that he has been a return guy and a really damn good one for the Texans, in the situation that he's going in the running back room with Dari and Woody Marks and Chubb and Mixon?
It helps a lot. It's one more thing, especially when it comes down to final cuts and you start looking at, all right, just exactly which guys do we really like having on special teams. I think it gets a little murkier now because for one, you've got Braxton Berrios on the team, and he's going to get a lot of, if he makes the squad. I mean, there's going to be battles on special teams. That might end up being one of the weird decisions you're making between, okay, are we going to keep Braxton Berrios or keep Damian Pierce because of the potential return ability? But at the same time, you know, Jalen Noel can be a returner. How much do you want to use him early in his career? How much do you trust him? I like having Damian back there. There's going to be more returns this year because of the rule change. The touchback now is at the 35. So last year, where a lot of teams were just flat out saying this new kickoff format, no, we're just going to boot it into the end zone and that'll be that.
Yeah.
This year, there's probably going to be a lot more returns.
So
that it becomes that much more of a factor in the decision making.
Need to see more Damian Pierce in those explosive runs, man. What do you have? One of 100 yards, 99 yards last year, I think, for the Texans. That's fun. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. Coming up next, we'll get back to some Rockets. Inside some numbers, how much better are the Rockets going to really be off the ball with Kevin Durant? That's next. In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. Appreciate you joining us this morning. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, 713-572-4610. You can text. You can also join the chat via YouTube or Twitch. Just going back and forth with somebody during the break on the text line, texted in, said, dude, Pierce is not making this team. I'm surprised he hadn't been cut yet. And I just said, like, dude, you're not going to cut a guy going into the final year of his rookie contract despite having Joe Mixon, Nick Chubb, Woody Marks, Darian Gumbawale in the running back room. Guys get hurt. You're going to allow them to compete, and Pierce is good and has been good in – you know, in his NFL career, that rookie season that he had, there's no way you're cutting him right now. Like, you don't know what he's going to look like just yet in a Nick Haley offense.
Yeah, no, I think they definitely have established they like the upside or believe in, you know, Damian Pierce perhaps in a different system and with different coaching. He was always a square peg in a round hole when it came to trying to do the outside zone stuff. The trouble with that a little bit is that you're gonna run outside zone plays. It's not like you'd have to be an outside zone based team, but you're still gonna run outside zone plays. And does Damian Pierce do better in it with the coaching of Nick Haley and with a better offensive lineman in front of him? But then also just, I think they are gonna be more of an old school traditional man blocking run game that does suit Damian Pierce. So certainly, I wouldn't cut him right now. I think you want to see how he responds to the system. But it's depending on how Nick Chubb looks and how well he's recovered and how they feel about his health. Like, that's it's going to be hard for Damian Pierce to make the team. I mean, it's just there's a lot of running backs right now. And you've got two fullbacks in Yakov Johnson and British Brooks competing. They're definitely going to keep a fullback on the team. You drafted Woody Marks. Agumbawale is really good on special teams. It's going to be a hard room to make.
Yeah, this is a huge training camp. Consider this. You say it's going to be really hard for Pierce to make the team. Okay, but guys get hurt. And then two, we can't get comfortable at all and hang our hat on Nick Chubb, you know, making it through a camp and being, you know, even half of what we know Nick Chubb to have already been at this stage of his NFL career. And you mentioned Braxton Berrios, return guy. Texans brought him in earlier this offseason, wide receiver. Like, you know, he's got to stay healthy too. He's got to, you know, perform and play well. There is competition throughout. I don't think between receiver, running back, and return men, to me, it's not easy at all right now to pencil in anybody.
No, and I mean, obviously, John Metchie and Xavier Hutchinson are very much in a prove-it type of scenario. I feel like Xavier Hutchinson, in some respects, I almost feel like he got a leg up just because the Texans drafted two other Iowa State receivers, and that doesn't make any logical sense at all, other than that I think Casario citing how many of the things that Xavier Hutchinson has done well as far as learning the offense and how polished he was coming out makes me feel like they still believe that about Xavier Hutchinson. And there's just you get more of a warm and fuzzy feel about him than perhaps John Metchie right now.
Yeah, I don't know about warm and fuzzy, but I like him better than Magic.
I'm more of a warm and fuzzy. I'm not saying it's 100% warm and fuzzy. It's a, if you had to pick, if you had to count up warm and fuzzies versus cold pricklies, you just got a few more with Xavier.
Yeah. When you put it
it's
that way.
It's not a wealth of warm fuzzies.
When you put it that way, for sure. Hey, we talked about this yesterday, a little bit, and shout out Jackson Gatlin. As we get back to a little Rocket conversation here. You remember it was the exit interview day when Rafael Stone and Ime Udoka were available to the media. Jackson Gatlin asked both of those guys, like, hey, your thoughts on the player and team efficiency numbers when Jalen Green is on the court versus when he is off the court. This is what it sounded like at that point in time.
There's a decent amount of lineup data that suggests this team has performed better without Jalen Green on the court this season. How much do you incorporate that kind of data into your decision-making process moving forward, be it roster construction, coaching decisions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a really flawed question. So, like, we have there's great data that we have and we use. One of my favorite things that I tell him when we have new coaches join, one of my favorite things to tell him is I can make data say whatever I want it to say. We heavily use it, but we're very careful to try and really parse it out. And I would say that I would say that some of our very best lineups include him, and so that piece by itself, I just think that's just not correct.
Yeah, that piece itself and the specific stats you cited, and yet it words actions speak louder than words and numbers, and. Yeah. I mean, if you were frustrated at any point last year for Udoka not playing Jalen Green in critical stretches in the fourth quarter of games and what have you, I mean, their actions kind of spoke about probably how they really felt about Jalen Green and where he was and his decision-making, his passing, his reading of defenses, all of that. It wasn't just the playoffs where all of a sudden you saw signs that maybe the Rockets might not be as high on Jalen Green as some of the Jalen Green stands. They showed it with their actions throughout.
Yeah. To me, Rafael Stone treated that question like as a I gotcha question. Like the follow-up that I would have liked, somebody to ask, and I don't know if Jackson was even given the opportunity after that. I don't know what stage of the press conference that came, but it's like, what data are you looking at that says otherwise? Because we treat, these kind of interactions in media versus players and GMs and coaches so much as like, I'm going to pin this guy down versus we're trying to fact find here. We have questions. We want to know why. We want to better understand what you're seeing, how you're grading and evaluating all of these things. I would have liked to have known the answer to that question, and maybe actions, as you said, speak a little bit more louder than words. Jalen Green, not a Houston Rocket right now. Kevin Durant, very much a Houston Rocket right now.
Yeah, the GMs, when they're in defending their players, that's where it just comes off the most egregiously. Like last year, Nick Caserio said that it was a false narrative that the offensive line was struggling. And I would say it was a false narrative if you were saying the offensive line was the only issue with the pass protection, because there were issues at every level of the defense in pass protection, including the offensive coordinator. But the offensive line, by evidence, by the fact that the Texans got rid of three of their starting offensive linemen, that seems to tell me that the actions are a lot louder than saying it's a false narrative that the offensive line is struggling. Likewise with Rafael Stone saying that those stats are either primitive or they don't tell the story or whatever. All right, you did just ship off Jalen Green. I feel like it was a little bit more on the nose than you wanted it. I mean, understandably so. It was the right and smart thing for him to do, to voice nothing but support for Jalen Green right up until the moment they traded him.
Rafael Stone said he can make data say whatever he wants it to say. Jackson Gatlin on Twitter last night had the data. I want to know from you what you think this says. Jalen Green versus Kevin Durant regular season passing stats. 82 games played for Jalen Green. He had 282 assists. Only 62 games played for Kevin Durant. He had 263 assists. So just 19 shy from Jalen Green and 20 fewer games played.
Yeah.
Jalen Green, 49 hockey assists. That's a pass that leads to another pass that ends up resulting in a basket. Green had 49 of those. Durant had 44 of those. Potential assists, Jalen Green, 549 versus Kevin Durant, 470. Mind you, Durant played in 20 fewer games than Jalen Green. When I see these stats, I have at least two takeaways. Do you have any when you hear those for the first time?
I think it just kind of jives with what you're hoping to see out of the offense is more ball movement. You've got a guy.
Bingo.
Yeah. Like it's just Kevin Durant isn't just sitting around there waiting for a catch and shoot opportunity or anything. That you want to see the ball whipping around the perimeter. You want to see guys that have the vision to understand that, hey, when I'm doubled, that's opportunities for other guys and knowing exactly where to go with the ball. Yeah, Durant adds that to your team while at the same time opening things up just by his actual ability to score.
Yeah, I hope I didn't blow anybody's brains up reading all of those numbers. You know, it's 7:51 early in this morning. But ball movement is absolutely where my mind went. And then number two, this is where I need to see things happen. You know, we need to see it to believe it kind of a thing, right? Kevin Durant on the court for the Rockets, offense is going to be better. Okay,
yeah.
What about when Kevin Durant has the ball? We mentioned, you know, his deference, you know, in passing and ability to move the ball around the court, something that absolutely was non-existent for the Rockets last year. Durant played with Devin Booker. Durant played with Bradley Beal. Booker, you know, averaged 25 points per game last year with the Suns. Beal averaged nearly 18 points per game last season with the Suns. The Rockets don't have, you know, anybody that scores the way that those guys do on the team, and nor as much as they do on the team right now. I think what we think we know we're going to see from this Rockets team is a little bit further away than reality.
It's that it's what you think you know is further away from reality than...
I think what we think we're going to see from this Rockets team in terms of, like, ball dispersion, who's going to be the leading scorer, who's going to be the number two, who's going to be the number three. Like, Alperen averaged 19 points. Fred VanVleet, 14. Amen, 14. Jabari, 12. I don't think that those guys fall exactly in line this upcoming season as they did last year. I don't think we understand at all how the Rockets and Ime Udoka are going to really utilize these players offensively yet.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of what you had last year, too, was that, all right, you can, in any given night, you don't know exactly necessarily who's going to be your big guy or your second biggest guy scoring.
That's it, yeah, exactly.
That you're going to see a lot of that, hopefully, yeah. And that it's a genuine, just feels like a genuine offensive team as opposed to individual scores.
Yeah, the ball movement's going to be interesting to see because it just looked awful last year at times. Coming up next, we'll roll into the 8 o'clock hour. We've got the petty cast. Seth is feeling petty about some things, and we've got all kinds of stuff that we should celebrate next. It's petty cast. Stay there.